morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Jeremy Barron, and I'm here on behalf of Jose Miguel Gutierrez. I intend to save 2 minutes for rebuttal, and I will watch the clock. Your Honors, Mr. Gutierrez did not enter a knowing and voluntary guilty plea in this case, and he should have the opportunity to withdraw his plea. There are a number of problems with the plea colloquy here, but I'd like to start by focusing on the inaccurate advice that Mr. Gutierrez's attorney gave him about his probation eligibility on count two.
Okay, and let me just ask you real quick. Did the inaccurate advice come just at the plea colloquy, or did it come before that?
It's on the record in the plea colloquy, and Mr. Gutierrez has alleged in his petition in federal court and in state court that that's what he believed, and he never got accurate advice about probation eligibility beforehand. So he didn't have the chance.
Wait. I'm just trying to figure out, because this is my understanding, and I want you to correct me if I'm wrong. My understanding is that he decided to plead guilty, not knowing about this probation eligibility thing, showed up at the hearing where he was already prepared to plead guilty, and that's when he heard this inaccurate advice. So if that's the state of the record, I don't understand how could it have been material to his decision if he wasn't given that inaccurate advice before he showed up and was standing there ready to plead guilty, and the first time he heard it was when he was in the process of pleading guilty. It seems to me that's not material. So that's what I wanted you to help me with.
Well, Mr. Gutierrez has never testified about what his attorney told him ahead of time. He alleged in the federal petition in this case that when he entered the plea, he believed he was eligible for probation on count two, and he's alleged in his state court proceedings that he never got accurate advice before the plea colloquy. So if the court is concerned about, well, what did the attorney tell him ahead of time and what did he think ahead of time, then there ought to be a remand so that he can testify on that issue.
Do you disagree with the premise of my question to you that if he learned for the first time at the hearing where he was already prepared to plead guilty, right, that maybe he would be eligible for probation on this count, that would not call into question whether his plea was knowing and voluntary?
Yes, because if he didn't know one way or the other, then that means he didn't have information about one of the direct consequences of the guilty plea. And under Boykin, in order to make a constitutionally sound decision to plead guilty...
Well, no, because I don't think you need to know the range of penalties. You need to know the statutory max, that's for sure. I think that's all the Supreme Court has told us, right? We have circuit precedent that goes further, but in terms of what the Supreme Court has told us, it has never said you need to be advised as to what I don't even think it said you need to know necessarily that... you would be eligible for probation or not. You just need to know that the maximum you're looking at is 20 years or something.
Boykin has language suggesting the full range matters, but circuit precedent does matter in this case because we're able to get around AEDPA's standard of review under Section 2254D2 because the state Supreme Court's decision in this case rested on a fundamental, unreasonable determination of the fact when they said that Mr. Gutierrez got consistent advice at the plea colloquy and the belatedly filed written plea agreement when, in fact, the advice was inconsistent.
Did they say it was consistent, or did they just say there was no confusion?
The exact phrasing that the Nevada Supreme Court used is that the district court found that the penalties in the written plea agreement were consistent with the penalties discussed during the arraignment, so Gutierrez entered his plea knowingly and voluntarily. So they're saying that the guilty plea agreement was late, but it was accurate about the penalties, and the plea colloquy was also accurate about the penalties. That's how I read the Nevada Supreme Court's decision in this case, and that's an unreasonable determination of the fact because...
Well, they're consistent if all that matters is the maximum, right? It depends what matters when you're looking at whether they're consistent, so it's not obvious that that's an inaccurate statement.
Well, the claim before the Nevada Supreme Court was he got bad advice about probation eligibility. That makes his plea unknowing and involuntary.
But they don't say anything about advice, I don't think, at least in what you just read. I don't remember them commenting on whether the advice he'd gotten from his counsel was consistent over time or consistent with what happened. They don't speak to the advice he got from his counsel, do they?
Well, that was the main focus of the claim in the briefing before the Nevada Supreme Court was this same error about probation eligibility. And the Nevada Supreme Court rejected that and essentially said, no, we think he got accurate advice about his probation eligibility. But
is there somewhere where they say we think he got accurate advice?
Well, all they say is that the penalties in the plea agreement were consistent with the penalties discussed during the arraignment. And when they say penalties, presumably they mean probation eligibility, too, because that was one of the main issues raised on appeal. So they don't quite say accurate, but I think that's the only way to read their decision. And that's an unreasonable determination of the facts.
Yes, maybe it is, but it seems to me it relates to a legally irrelevant point. And so if that's true, then I don't think we can get around it, but deference.
Well, the claim was phrased, I got bad advice about my probation eligibility. That makes my plea violate Boykin. And in response, the Nevada Supreme Court essentially said, we disagree with the factual premise of that claim. And since
But I'm saying, I guess, I don't think we as this three-judge panel, bound by AEDPA as we are, I don't think we can say that if you don't know whether you're probation eligible for an offense, that renders your guilty plea unknowing and involuntary. I don't think we can say that because the Supreme Court has not gone that far yet.
Right, but if the Nevada Supreme Court has made an unreasonable determination of the fact, then it goes on to de novo review, and in that case, the panel would be bound by circuit precedent, which has said that Boykin requires information about the direct consequences, and that includes the full sentencing range.
But doesn't the unreasonable determination of the facts need to be relevant? I mean, if they start the hearing by saying today is Tuesday and it's actually Wednesday, we don't get out of the AEDPA deference.
Well, I don't see how the determination of the fact in the Nevada Supreme Court's opinion could be irrelevant because the claim is a Boykin claim, and this is the logic that the Nevada Supreme Court is using in refuting the Boykin claim and saying it has no merit. Is they're saying he got consistent advice throughout the entire proceedings.
The thing that he needed to know, which was the maximum exposure. That's, I guess, from a federal constitutional standpoint, that seems to me, as the law stands now, that's the only thing that matters in terms of what the Supreme Court has said.
Well, I think that if the Nevada Supreme Court had said the defendant raises a Boykin claim based on inaccurate advice about probation eligibility, we don't think Boykin requires accurate advice about probation eligibility, so we're going to affirm on that basis, that would be one thing. But the Nevada Supreme Court didn't say that. What they said is that the penalties discussed at the colloquy are consistent with the penalties discussed during the arraignment. And when this court is reviewing the state court's decision on the question of deference, you need to look at the actual reasoning that the state court used. And the reasoning the state court used here relies on a fundamental misreading of the record. And in that circumstance, if you look at cases like Maxwell versus Roe, if there is a fundamental misreading of the record, that gets the petitioner around D2, around...
So I'd like to go back to Judge Watford's first question or second question about the record here. So is there anything that would have prevented your client from submitting in the state court a declaration that said, I was given the wrong advice before this hearing?
Well, he alleged that in the petition.
I know, but it's not signed or verified or anything, right? So is that evidence, the petition itself, if it's not sworn?
Well, they raised a claim on this basis in state court. The state court set a hearing, and I believe that Mr. Gutierrez was prepared to testify on that issue at the hearing. But during the hearing, sort of out of nowhere, the state court
says... It got derailed, right.
Yeah, I just want to hear about the appeal.
But then why couldn't he have submitted a declaration at that point? I mean, I'm just concerned about whether we really could even develop this record in federal court if it could have been developed in state court, and I don't totally understand what prohibited it from getting developed in state court.
I think asking for a hearing is enough. He asked for a hearing, he was prepared to testify on that issue, and the state court unreasonably limited the scope of the hearing and under the
But it seems like it didn't need to be a hearing. I mean, all he needed to do is submit a declaration, right? Or an affidavit or some sort of sworn statement about his understanding from his counsel before the hearing.
That might have made the record stronger, but he did ask for a hearing, and I think that's all he was required to do.
Where did he even allege that he got advice before the plea colloquy hearing?
His first petition isn't quite as clear on that point, but the second petition he filed in state court, he does allege that, and that's at EOR 191.
And but then we have the problems of whether he was procedurally barred at that point, right? So does it need to be in the first petition?
The record might have been better if it was in the first petition, but the lawyer who was appointed to represent him made the allegation that he received inaccurate advice about the probation eligibility, asked for a hearing on that subject, was prepared to present.
Before showing up? got the inaccurate advice before showing up for the hearing?
Yeah, I'm not sure the first state court petition is totally clear on that point.
I'm talking about the second. Mm-hmm. ER 191, I'm going to go and look at. I don't have it in front of me, but I'm going to go look at that, and he's going to allege there that in the discussions leading up to my decision to plead guilty, my lawyer told me that I was going to be eligible for probation on count two or whatever it was.
He alleges his counsel was ineffective when he did not advise me of the proper penalty at arraignment and prior to the plea, and so his plea was involuntary as a result. So he says prior to the plea in there. And I see I've eaten into my rebuttal time if there are no further questions.
We'll give you a couple minutes for
rebuttal.
Thank you. Let's hear from the state.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Lawrence Van Dyke on behalf of the state defendants. I'd like to address three things this morning. First, I'd like to start with the AEDPA deference argument on this probation eligibility claim, and then related to that, that probation eligibility claim, because I think they really bleed into each other. Those are very similar things. And then hopefully I can get to his argument on the concurrent sentences. On the AEDPA deference issue, I think this is a much easier case than it's been presented to the court on AEDPA deference. By my count, Mr. Gutierrez in his briefing says at least 16 times that the Nevada Supreme Court characterized Mr. Gutierrez's trial counsel's statement about probation eligibility as, quote, correct or, quote, accurate. If you add those together in his two briefs, I think he says that 16 times. And as you just saw this morning, the Nevada Supreme Court actually never said that. And the reason the Nevada court never said that is because, as Mr. Gutierrez's counsel mentioned this morning, this claim, just like it's been well presented to this court, was well presented to the Nevada courts. The Nevada courts were very aware that Mr. Gutierrez's counsel had made that incorrect statement at the plea colloquy, so it's not like they didn't realize that he'd made an incorrect statement. And that's why what they actually said was the penalties in the written plea memorandum were consistent with the penalties discussed during the arraignment. Not accurate, not correct, not even the word same. The word was consistent. And that's important because if Nevada courts had said accurate or if they had said correct, then I'm not sure they would be due AEDPA deference.
I don't understand. How you're parsing the language, it seems to me, quite finely here. What do you think the word consistent means there?
I think what the word consistent, I'm about to show that if the word consistent even means the same range, in other words, the Ninth Circuit's standard in Little, if it means that, then the Nevada Supreme Court was correct. Because actually what Mr. Gutierrez was told throughout all at the plea colloquy, in the plea memorandum, and at the sentencing, what he was told at all of those was in fact consistent, if you interpret consistent to be consistent with this court's own precedent.
What do you mean? What do you think it means? What did they mean when they said consistent?
I think what they meant was that it made no difference. I think that's what they meant. And that's something like, I think what they meant was it's something like the Seventh Circuit's, like the Second Circuit standard of a harmless error. And let me explain to you why I think that means that. I think one of the misunderstandings that Mr. Gutierrez has made to this court is that somehow this plea eligibility statement on count two, or probation eligibility statement, would have made a difference in his. He actually has inconsistent arguments, if you think about it. On one hand,
actually, they're totally consistent, and I'll lay it out for you, because I could see how this would be relevant. He knows he's not getting probation, because he's got, what is it, a 10-year mandatory
10-year maximum minimum.
So he's going to prison for 10 years.
Yep.
What he wants to be assured of is that I'm not going to get extra time tacked on top of that.
Yep.
And so there's two things that are relevant. One, tell me I'm probation eligible, which means maybe the judge will take mercy on me and not give me any more time. He says that he was going to get concurrent sentences. So to me, those are totally consistent with one another, and it makes sense that he was already concerned that, man, this seems like a lot of time for this little drug thing I've done.
I think you're right, Your Honor, except for the fact that you used and you should have used or, because in fact, in the way you just characterized it, because if he had actually, the reason they're inconsistent is because if he had actually been if he had been told that I'm going to get concurrent sentences, period, then as Mr. Gutierrez acknowledges on page 12 or 13 of his reply brief, then count two would become a nullity, practically speaking. He wouldn't have been worried about, if he really thought he was going to get concurrent sentences, then who cares about whether or not he would have gotten probation eligibility? Because whether probation eligible or not, count two essentially disappears. And so,
I get double protection from any having to.
Well, what you can do
time,
is you could,
right?
That would have to be his argument, which I would say. Certainly the Supreme Court has not spoken.
I am not doing a day's extra time because, number one, the judge might give me probation, and if he does give me any time, it's going to be run concurrently.
That's what his argument reduces to, is I want the judge to have two options to reach this result, because the truth is, it's really important for the court to understand, because of the fact that he knew that he could get concurrent sentences here, the probation eligibility on count two doesn't matter at all, because the maximum minimum that the court could have given him if he wasn't probation, if it's not probation eligible under the real world, would have been 10 years, minimum maximum, as Your Honor said. But if the maximum amount, if he'd been probate, or the minimum maximum he could have gotten if he was probation eligible was exactly the same, 10 years, because all the judge would have to do is sentence him concurrently. So the minimum of his range on his plea deal is exactly the same under each of these. And the maximum is 40 years. It's exactly the same, because if the judge sentences him consecutively, then he's looking at 40 years. And the maximum minimum, which is 10 years on count one and 6 years on count two, which is actually what he got because the judge threw the book at him, is exactly the same because the judge had the discretion. So
you're saying because they could be concurrent, the minimum is actually the same either way.
What I'm saying, Your Honors, is that if you look at this, if even under the Ninth Circuit's precedent, and under the Seventh Circuit's and the Ninth Circuit's range of possible sentences under Little, under the Nevada Supreme Court's consistent, again, not the same, not the accurate, not correct, just saying, you know, what he was told was consistent because the range the judge had was exactly the same. The judge could have given him 10 years, he could have given him 40 years, he could have given him 16 mandatory minimum. He had all exactly the same options. It did not make a bit of difference. The only difference it makes, Judge Wofford, is what you said, and that is it gives the judge two ways to be able to get to the same result instead of one way. I can't imagine that EPA requires... that there's no U.S. Supreme Court thing that says, well, you know, one of the things you got to know as a direct consequence of your plea deal is whether or not the judge can have another way of getting to the same result. In other words, it makes no difference whatsoever.
So maybe address the concurrent sentences promise, the alleged promise, because that, I guess I...
Because this becomes very important once you understand what I just said. Yes.
Yeah, and the Nevada Supreme Court didn't seem to address that at all. Or what am I missing? Because I don't understand how you think we can affirm on that. Claim he without an evidentiary hearing. He says my lawyer promised me that I was going to get concurrent sentences. That it seems to me is highly relevant to the decision to plead guilty or not.
So
right?
what the district court. I think there's two things. I think there's what you'd call indirect evidence, and I think there's direct evidence that goes against what the district court characterized accurately, I think, as Mr. Gutierrez's bare contention that he was promised consecutive concurrent sentences. And so I'll start with the indirect evidence. The indirect evidence is the sentencing hearing, and I acknowledge that the sentencing hearing is only relevant in the sense of what it can tell us what we think happened back during the plea colloquy, during the plea deal. And if you look at the sentencing hearing, what you've got is you've got almost the entirety of the transcript of the sentencing hearing is Mr. Gutierrez's counsel saying, Your Honor, we really ask that you give consecutive sentencing here. We know the sentencing recommendation says concurrent, but we really ask that you give concurrent.
He's not arguing for concurrent.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
It's not consecutive.
In mooting these cases, I never could get it right, but I know that you guys have. Okay, so we know his counsel is asking for concurrent sentencing, but he's acknowledging the sentencing recommendation is consecutive. Meanwhile, the prosecution gets up, says, go with the sentencing recommendation, give us consecutive sentencing. This whole thing goes on. Meanwhile, and Mr. Gutierrez is sitting there the entire time. We know that. Meanwhile, Mr. Gutierrez, just before this, has been read the sentencing recommendation in the pre-sentencing report that says specifically that he should get consecutive sentencing. So Mr. Gutierrez, if you look in the record, what he does is he jumps up and he says, Your Honor, this is the first I've heard about consecutive sentencing. What is all this talk about consecutive sentencing, right? That's why they don't. They don't argue that because it's not there. Instead, the judge says, Mr. Gutierrez, it's your turn. I want to hear from you. And what does Mr. Gutierrez says? What he says is, I'm in your hands. That's it. It's all up to you now. Not a word about not having heard this, but that's the indirect evidence. But I want to get to the direct evidence because I think it's even, there's more, even more. Than, wait, there's more. During the same sentencing hearing, Mr. Gutierrez's counsel is talking to the judge, and he's saying, listen, back when we were, this is on excerpts of record 89 through 90. He's saying, Judge, back when we were entering into this, when we were in the midst of plea negotiations, he uses the word plea negotiations, he basically tells the judge, we were really hoping for concurrent sentencing. We want you to give us consecutive sentencing because we were really hoping for consecutive sentencing. And then almost as if he knows the judge is going to jump on him and interrupt him and say, wait a minute, I never promised you consecutive sentencing. He specifically says to the judge, right after telling him, this is what we were doing back when we were negotiating.
Concurrent.
Give me the page again.
Excerpts of record 89 through 90.
Okay, because I'm that on that page in my book.
Bottom of the page 89, if I remember correctly.
Is a Mr. Naka talking? You know what? Maybe I'm in the wrong. I might be in the wrong thing.
Yeah, I have Mr. Naka.
Yeah. Okay. So what page are you looking at?
Excerpts of record 89.
Okay, and what's going on page 89 of your thing?
Yeah, Mr. Naka. They misspelled his name, but it's the same. It's his trial counsel. And he says, very, very bottom paragraph, starting on line 23, he says, I would ask you, he's talking to the judge.
Okay.
Yep. He says, I would ask you to follow the original intent of the negotiation. He's talking about it, of a 2 to 15. He's talking about count 2, as outlined when we took the plea, and as outlined in the plea agreement. Which, of course, and then he, it's almost like he interrupts himself and he says, now, wait a minute, Judge, I know you're going to jump on me and tell me that, wait a minute, I never promised you concurrent sentences. So he says, which, of course, I've explained to Mr. Gutierrez, it's entirely up to you is how you're going to sentence him. But I would ask that you, that on count 2, you sentence him to 2 to 15 and run that concurrent to count 1, not consecutive. So right here in the record, we have Mr. Gutierrez's counsel. In addition to the indirect evidence, we have what I think is direct evidence.
Well, we have an evidentiary conflict between what his lawyer is representing to the court and what Mr. Gutierrez is saying he was actually told, right?
But here's the deal. The Nevada courts looked at this, and under EPA, I think you need to defer to their factual conclusions unless no court could reasonably conclude that the finding was supported by the record. So under EPA, I think that his claims fail because I think the district court was correct that his bare assertion cannot overcome either the, I don't think it could even overcome the indirect evidence. But when you add this language in the record of his own counsel saying, listen, I told him that it's up to you, Judge, and then you add his own language, it's up to you, Judge. I just think the Nevada, under EPA, maybe if this court was to decide it on their own, but under EPA, I think you have to defer to the Nevada court's conclusion because I don't think it's true that no court could reasonably conclude that finding was supported.
Where did the Nevada court make that conclusion?
I don't think
that. Was it the Supreme Court or was it the trial court?
Well, the Supreme Court upheld the trial court. I don't recall, honestly, standing here, whether or not the Nevada court made an explicit conclusion on the concurrent sentences claim. If they didn't, then I think this court all the more so.
Well, I thought the concurrent sentences problem was that it was in the second petition, which they then said was untimely, and also said this kind of weird thing about how it was already decided, which I'm not quite sure what that meant.
Well, you're right. I mean, if they decided it, then I think this court, if they decided it but they don't have a rationale, then I think under this court's EPA, under EPA, then this court would all the more so defer to it if it's supported by any reasonable decision, which I just gave you one. And if it's not decided, if he waived it in district court, then I'm not sure he can raise it here. But I think the Nevada Supreme Court said it was if they said it was decided, but they didn't give a reason, then you would just defer to their reason as long as it's can be supported by if it can be supported. And I just gave you a reason why it can be supported. So, Your Honor.
I guess I do have one question about this issue of the fact that he's alleged that he got bad advice, but never had a sworn declaration. Do you have any case you can point us to that tells us whether that matters? Like, did he do enough in state court to put this issue before the state court?
I thought you were asking something else. So I did want to respond. Maybe this is answers you, but maybe it doesn't. So let me know if it. In the hearing, Judge Wofford had asked about, did he come in? What's the evidence that he come into the plea? Is there any evidence that he hadn't been told this before? And there is that one statement. Of course, that statement too is a bare contention that's somewhat at odds with the record because if you actually look at the plea colloquy, he actually pleads guilty. He actually says he's going to plead guilty long before the statement is ever made by his counsel. I don't know if that's response. I mean,
but at least in the second state habeas petition, he says the thing about I'm not going to remember the exact words, but not having been told before the plea of what his range was. So he has that in the petition. I'm just not sure what we should do with that, whether that complied with state law in terms of getting that issue to have enough evidence, or whether he needed to have a declaration, or what we do. Can he have a declaration now that he didn't do then? I'm not sure what we do with the state of the evidence.
Because the Nevada court said they rejected the second one, the second petition as untimely. And so what you're asking is, well, they rejected it as untimely, is there enough evidence in an untimely petition? And I don't know. I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. I'm not sure that anybody's ever addressed that because if it's untimely and therefore rejected by the state courts, it would be odd to rely on it as somehow establishing evidence because the courts never got sorted out in the state court system as evidence because they found a procedural way to kind of get away from it. The short answer is I'm not aware of any authority on that. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you, counsel, for your argument. We'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. We spoke a lot this morning about the probation eligibility issue and a little bit about the concurrent consecutive issue, but I want to emphasize there are a lot of problems with this plea colloquy. It starts off, there's confusion about which information is governing. There's confusion about which the counts in the information correspond to which alleged sales. There's confusion about the prison ranges on count two, not just probation, but the actual prison ranges. There's no discussion of concurrent or consecutive sentencing at the colloquy, nor in the guilty plea agreement. There's no written guilty plea agreement filed at the time of the plea colloquy. There's no explicit discussion of the elements. And then midway into the plea colloquy, Mr. Gutierrez makes this comment about, I can't believe I'm facing so much time for this crime. And defense counsel goes into this long discussion of how Mr. Gutierrez isn't really comfortable with the deal, but it's a good deal, so maybe the court ought to pass the case to give him, and I'm quoting here, more time to fully comprehend the situation. But if the court passes the case, that means the DA is going to pull the deal, and that's going to be bad for Mr. Gutierrez. So if the court accepts the deal today, that might create a writ issue down the line, but the court should do that. And the court agrees and sets the case down for sentencing. So this is a problematic plea colloquy. There's no affirmative showing in this plea colloquy that the plea was knowing and voluntary when it was entered. And as a result, Mr. Gutierrez should have the chance to withdraw the plea or at the very least testify in federal court on some of the issues we've discussed today.
May I ask a question? The claim that Gutierrez believed that he was going to receive concurrent sentences, was that claim developed during the state habeas proceeding?
I'm not sure if that specific allegation was in the first petition. I would have to go back and check that. It certainly was in the second petition, and the Nevada court said the content of the second petition was already decided in the first round, so they essentially applied a law of the case ruling.
But they said it was untimely.
So do we have a procedural default, an adequate and independent state ground for rejecting the concurrent consecutive issue?
I would have to double check. I thought that one of the things that the state court said with the second petition was that all the substance was identical to the claims that were raised before.
Well,
there may have been a timeliness.
Things. It said it was untimely and already decided. So we have two. And so if one of those is adequate and independent, it seems like there's a procedural default problem.
Well, if the state post-conviction counsel didn't raise the concurrent consecutive, and I'd have to double check to make sure, but if post-conviction counsel didn't raise that claim, there would be a potential Martinez issue there, and we think that would warrant
but
further
factual. But that hasn't been raised yet, has it?
Well, I don't think there's been any argument that the concurrent consecutive issue wasn't fairly presented to the state court, so I'm not sure that the briefing has been responsive to that issue. If there are no further questions.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, counsel. Case just argued will be submitted. Do you all want to-